Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing great. Well, this weather is really got me feeling good. I threw on my shorts today.
Yeah, I saw that. I like that. Bringing the spring fever vibe.
Exactly. It's April. I'm ready for it.
That's so true. Oh, my gosh. Today we have a guest in the studio to have a conversation about a topic that I know very little to nothing about, which is always fun.
Okay,
because you and I both like to learn new things.
Yeah, we are very curious people.
We are curious people. So I'm looking forward to being more educated on this topic. And it kind of falls in line with this theme that comes up all the time in my classes. You know, and I'm in a new quarter at school and kind of getting to know all of my students again. Each quarter is kind of a do-over of getting to know them getting to know me, trying to kind of set what the expectations are in class. And one of the things I talk about every quarter at the beginning is that when we're talking about mental health and physical health and our lives in general, we have to remember that nothing in life is all good or all bad. That we like to conveniently try to categorize things that we experience. You know, this is the good pile, this is the bad pile, I'll just pay attention to the good pile and life will be okay. But it's really not that simple.
That makes you feel manic, too, when it's that way, when it's either all good or all bad. It's got to have a little bit of that gray in the middle.
Right. And I think everything does, and in some ways that's much to our chagrin, everything has a bit of bad or good, because then it makes the free will part of our human experience much more challenging, because then it falls on us to be able to weigh the good and the bad of any choices that we make and then kind of go with our educated guess or our educated experience or our best hope for the best quality of life. And so today's show is going to really kind of fall into that category of nothing in life being all good or all bad, because we're going to talk about prednisone, which I've only known as a steroid for dealing with hives or a rash or an anti-inflammatory. Pretty benign, didn't really know the depth or the magnitude of all of the things that we address with prednisone. And it reminded me, in kind of doing the research about it, that we have to be mindful of our own care, that we really have to be our own advocates when it comes to our health and well-being, because prednisone is used, you know, mostly, I don't know how familiar you are, but it's used mostly to suppress the immune system and to decrease inflammation and to help things, issues. And there's so many, I can't name them all. I'm just going to give you a short list. Everything from asthma to COPD, rheumatoid arthritis, the gout, hives, poison ivy, different cancers, cluster headaches, the croup, acute leukemia, acute bronchitis, lupus, muscular dystrophy, carpal tunnel syndrome, Crohn's, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, various skin issues. And that's just the beginning. I mean, it is used and prescribed for a lot of issues.
I mean, I remember when I was not very sick and it was prescribed to me for something for inflammation. I was telling you earlier, my sister was very sick for a very long time and she's on the mend now, but that was a big part of her regimen. Being in the hospital, we were both on the same medicine, but for very different reasons.
Right, extremely different reasons. It's got a huge range of prescriptive uses. And, you know, when I was kind of doing the research on it, I found that in 2 weeks, short bursts, which are what most people get prescribed for, it's relatively safe, according to the research that's easy to find. One of the side effects, and of course, you know, we see the short list of side effects. We rarely look at the longer term list of side effects. But in the short term, I thought it was interesting, is that one of the side effects of prednisone is that you feel high. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that experience?
I don't remember feeling that. I've definitely felt that other things that I've taken prescribed before, but I don't remember that. But I do know that when my sister was on it, there was a whole range of issues that came from it, from being on it longer term,
right after that 2 week burst. Mm-hmm. And when I posted the show, I got a few different texts from people who responded to stories pretty quickly of their experience on prednisone, which surprised me, because I'll post the show and once or twice someone will, you know, say, hey, here's my thoughts or here's what happened. Today day, it was a lot of people very quickly saying, here's my prednisone story. And I was surprised that there were a few that said, I felt high the whole 2 weeks, and that was kind of fun. But other people talked about more long-term issues like thinning skin, more easily bruising, increased blood sugar, mood swings, memory loss, clouding in the eyes. You know, it just kind of went on and on. So because our conversation was going to focus more on acute responses to prednisone, I wanted to do a little deeper dive into some of the side effects, because although it listed all of those things when I did a quick Google search and the Mayo Clinic, when I did a different search into the Google Scholar and looked at some scholarly articles, all of a sudden there was a different story that started to unfold. And they talked a lot about psychiatric responses and mania and depression and anxiety in people that had not had any of those diagnoses before being on prednisone. And it wasn't huge numbers of people, you know, which is probably why the research isn't readily published when you look in an easy Google search. But it was a significant amount, 27% of people who had been on prednisone for a long period of time had some sort of psychiatric reaction. And so that piqued my interest more to have this conversation. And so the third piece of our story today is about the helplessness that we can feel when someone we love is suffering, and as their caregiver, their spouse, or their partner, how we feel like we want to jump in and do whatever we can to help our partners or help our child or whoever this person is we love that's suffering, and that we tend to trust the medical industry to give us the resources and the tools to be helpful caregivers. But quite often, you know, the pain can be so great that no matter what we do as partners, as soulmates, we can't stop the devastating struggles that people can experience when they have long-term health issues, and that the long-term health issue can be so overwhelming. And then you put on top of that the journey into medications and side effects and more medications, that it gets to a point where it's so untenable that the person can no longer be here and takes their own life. And so that's the story of my guest today, author Jill Stegman. Her book is One Pill Makes You Stronger: The Drug That Scorched My Soul. And Jill has experienced firsthand the side effects of prednisone because of the loss of her beloved husband, partner of 40 years, Don. And so I invited Jill in to tell her story. And I just want to hear Jill's story. As I said, I don't know much about prednisone or the effects of it. So I want to hear from Jill. And I also want to talk about the choices we face every day when we're caring for others and for ourselves. And how do we make those tough decisions? How do we know what to choose if things are not all good or all bad, and they're somewhere in the middle, and we hope for the best, but prepare ourselves for the worst? So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation by joining us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting our website, kcbx.org, and look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Or if you're interested, please podcast the show through Apple Podcasts or however you find them. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, and our show will be uploaded to your device so you can listen at your convenience and pass it along to friends. So as always, I appreciate you being a part of this conversation. I look forward to seeing where this next hour takes us. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
When you need me, call my name. 'Cause without you, my life just wouldn't be the same. If you want me, them sunny skies are rain. When you need me, just call my name. If you miss me, I'll be there to brush the sunlight from your hair. I'll be there.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And welcome to the show, Jill Stegman.
Thank you for having me here.
So, Jill, you wrote a book, One Pill Makes You Stronger, The Drug That Scorched My Soul, after losing your husband, Don.
Correct.
To suicide.
Yes.
And you reached out to me because clearly your experience of watching your husband suffer and then take his own life changed your life.
Yes.
And you have a story that you want people to hear so that other caregivers and spouses and loved ones may not have to go through the same pain.
Yes, that's a story I'd like to tell.
So I'm going to turn it over to you and share the story of your experience with your husband, Don, and prednisone.
Well, my husband, or Don, was prescribed, had his first encounter with prednisone in 2007 after a bone marrow transplant. At that time, prednisone was the drug of choice. There was no other choice, especially for, I think, for most transplant patients. It was, because of its in anti-inflammatory tactics, it was used post-operative, and patients then have a tendency to develop what they call graft versus host disease, where there's kind of a fight between the introduced graft and your own immune system. So it's a commonly used drug, and it's used on probably most transplant patients. Don started developing symptoms of mental lability, I guess you would call it, in his clinical visits after he was released from the hospital. And I talked to the doctors and the nurses there, and they just kind of laughed me off and said, yeah, you know, they're all kind of high, we call it. Kind of giddy, you know, that's just the way it is. And they just didn't take it very seriously. And he progressed to the point where he became really paranoid. He wouldn't leave our room to even go to the clinic. He wouldn't let me leave the room. And at that point, I just knew that something had to be done. It wasn't just a typical episode of what the doctors had experienced. So he finally said, yeah, I need to go, take me to the hospital. And I just physically took him to the hospital and dropped him in front of the doctor. And he literally slid to the floor, crying. And they admitted him at that point.
And how long had he been on the prednisone at that point?
Just about a month.
So it wasn't a long term at that point.
No, it wasn't that long that he experienced it. But he was on very, very high doses, up to the maximum of 180 milligrams a day. And he recuperated. They gave him psychotropic drugs. I can't remember the names of them all. And they released him, and we went home. And he had follow-up visits to the hospital. This hospital is about 200-mile drive from where we live at the time. So he did okay. He was still getting kind of depressed. It wasn't good, but they attributed it to just the reaction of going through a bone marrow transplant, which is in and of itself quite a feat. And he would go to the doctor, his doctor that he was still seeing, and he was told that he should just exercise more. And,
to lift his spirits.
Yeah, this was beyond exercise. So this continued on, and when she was just telling him to exercise more. And finally, he got to the point where he wasn't getting out of bed. And I said, okay, once again, we gotta do our own thing. And I got him into his local doctor, just his family practice doctor, and he was given a drug to raise his, you know, to get him out of the depression, which it helped. And then on and off, he was on prednisone for the next many years, never experiencing quite the depression that had happened. Then his final episode occurred in...
Was he taking the prednisone the whole time for the bone marrow transplant, or did it become something he took for other issues?
It became things that he took for that related to the graft-versus-host disease.
Okay.
He kept having flare-ups of that, of the skin, of the kidneys, and the last episode. But it was basically on a shorter-term basis. And he would become manic and euphoric and slightly volatile, but he was never like he had been before.
And so he went from being depressed on the meds to flipping to more manic.
Yes, he kind of started displaying what he was never actually diagnosed, but from what I understand it to be, he had violent mood swings and sort of a mood disorders.
Yeah, like bipolar.
Yes.
Which I had read in the deeper dive is that was one of the things they experienced, that people who had no symptoms before had developed bipolar down the road.
Yes.
Because of the antidepressants. Like they start, everything stacks up from prednisone to antidepressants and then back to prednisone.
Well, in his case, he had never even been given any more antidepressants.
So he was just
out there kind of going through the highs and lows, I think, of bipolar. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in around 2013, he developed a severe pneumonia reaction. And they attributed it to graft-versus-host disease, and he was back on prednisone. And at this time, he just really became out of control. He was violent. He was abusive, not so much physically, but quite verbally. Our marriage was just torn asunder by his rages and his accusations and his verbal assaults on me, mostly, or on anyone who happened to cross his path. It could have been a pharmacist, you know, a technician at CVS Pharmacy who managed to cross him. Definite road rage. And I was going with him to the hospital for a visit, and it got so bad that I just said, I can't do this. And he was just railing in the car. And he went on his way, and I said, I have to do something. So I went home, and I did some research about prednisone, and I thought, oh my God, look at all this, all these details, some of which you have uncovered yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was doing that. I thought, why am I doing this? Why don't the doctors know this? Why isn't somebody helping me?
Because at this point, were you not contributing or relating his behaviors to the prednisone? Did you not think there was a correlation?
I didn't know. I wasn't really sure. I knew that the prednisone made him react a certain way. And at this point, I figured that it had to be that. Because there weren't any other medications he was taking that could be attributed to that. And I contacted his doctor. I couldn't get her on the I did talk to her on the phone. I got her on the phone. He's up there, and I said, look, there's something really wrong with him. He needs help. He needs psychiatric intervention. And I guess he had had an incident in a parking lot with a parking lot attendant, and it told him off, and there was a big to-do about that, and the doctor had found out. And she said she told him that if I didn't know you, I'd think you were, you know, you're very scary. Mm. And so I said, but she said, I'm not going to give him anything. We're just going to taper him down from the drug. And I said, well, he needs this. I said, I believed her. I trusted her, and I believed that it would happen.
That if he came off the
yeah,
drug,
yeah, she said, we're going to taper him off. I thought that he was beyond just being tapered off. Some kind of intervention should have been made right then, but she wouldn't go along with it. So then I called his pulmonary specialist via email, and I asked him the same. I said, something needs to be done about him. You know, he's violent. He's a danger to himself and others. And he just said, no, I'm not going to prescribe any drugs for him. We'll take him off and he'll be fine.
And were you hoping that they might put him, you know, institutionalize him for a bit?
Yes.
Put him in a treatment center?
Oh, yes. At that point, it was not just to get him off my back.
Right. Because you were alone in this.
It was also that I knew that he was out of control and that he was capable of doing harm, and that something was very wrong with him. He was displaying these psychiatric psychosis symptoms, and I wanted some intervention that I thought he should have had. So he did. He was tapered, and he kind of gradually came down off of being manic and crazy and violent, for lack of better words. And then he kind of got quiet, and it wasn't a noticeable sign of depression as before when he simply just wouldn't get out of bed. He just didn't have the same verve and vitality as himself. He wasn't himself. And I just kind of thought, well, this is all the doctor said he would be fine, you know, and so I'll just have to, I don't have any other choice really at this point than to go along with what they want to say, because Don refused to go this time with me to see a psychiatrist or psychologist or get any kind of intervention, because at that point I was the enemy. And he was, you know, he was doing okay, and it was me who was the problem, which is, I guess, a common effect of someone going through a psychiatric situation. So we, and then one day we're at the beach walking. He said, you know, I've been afraid to tell you some things, and I'm willing to get help now. So I said, okay, let's do it. You know, we're a team. We've done this before. And then the couple, it was over the weekend, and in a couple of days, I started calling on a Monday morning, and about 10 o'clock, 9 or 10 o'clock, Don, I looked around, and Don had just sort of ran out the door. And I thought that was kind of puzzling, and I couldn't really figure it out, but I thought, well, he's been doing weird things, so, you know, who knows. But then he didn't come back, and he didn't come back, and then I started, you know, the hammer came down. I said, this doesn't seem right at all. There's something really, really wrong here. And I called the police, and they found him later that night, and he had taken his life. He had taken his an old shotgun we had lying around that just was stuck with the vacuum cleaner. And I had taken, when he was crazy, you know, he was acting so violent, I had taken it and hidden it, and he'd found it, and that was that.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Jill Stegman. Jill is an author who's written a memoir about her experience helping her husband, dealing with the loss and the grief afterward, and hoping to share with others her story so that maybe someone who's in the same position can help get more support going through dealing with medical agencies and trusting doctors, and also trying to come up with a plan of what do you do when you're the only person at home recognizing what's going on with your loved one. What is the plan that you can put into action to help them? Her book is One Pill Makes You Stronger, The Drug That Scorched My Soul. So, Jill, what happened at that point? I mean, your husband's committed suicide. You're now left alone with all these questions and probably concerns and sadness and shame and guilt. How did you kind of process what came next?
Well, the first thing that occurred to me was that it was just a terrible accident. That if he wasn't really mentally ill, it was kind of a weird disconnect. It's like it's not like someone who has gone through a long-term mental illness and this is the end result, and it's not, of course, expected, and it's just as tragic, but you've gone through a process already. This was just totally, it seemed like it was engineered by this chemical that had distorted his thinking, that had distorted his brain. And I just kept thinking that if he'd only waited and, you know, he'd gotten some help, some kind of intervention, probably in the form of a strong antidepressant, he wouldn't be like that. And we could recover and go on like we had before. So I think I had to, that took me a while to kind of process that. And then I realized that I was in the realm of other people who unfortunately had lost their loved ones to suicide, and that, you know, that was basically the end result. And so I went through what they call a complicated grief through that.
Okay.
I sought some psychiatric, I went to a few psychiatrists and I got some help that way with medication. I think that I kind of, I don't know. It was just all kind of a blur at this point. I did some things that were, I wish I hadn't done, in terms of probably drinking too much wine, definitely. And then I would just kind of talk my way out of it. In retrospect, I wish that I had had therapy. I think that going to a therapist who understood the situation was probably better than any kind of antidepressants I could have been on.
And so how long was this process of kind of working through the shock and the disbelief till you started to be able to kind of look back and reflect on what actually had occurred?
Well, I would say that there were phases of it. There were phases of time that I thought I was okay, and then I would kind of, you know, some part of it would, I would be dealing with it. I you know, it's probably the whole process, I would say, to get to where I am now has been 6 years. And it's 6 years that I would not want anyone else to have to go through. And that's part of the reason why I'm advocating now, why I wrote my book.
So at what point in the healing process did you start writing the book?
I started writing parts of it and publishing it probably within a year. They were very raw, emotional pieces. But I did find a few publishers for those pieces. And then I started in earnest, I would say, probably about 3 years. And it took me a year or so to finally come up, to categorize it and come up with an ending. Because when I started, I thought, you know, I'm writing toward the ending in a way.
Right. And so, looking back over this process, has it been 8 years? Can you do the math?
Well, it was in 2013.
Okay. So that's 6 years or so of this. What kind of things have you learned that you wish you had known while you were going through this process with Don?
Well, I wish I had known that more of how to contact the agencies that can help. Mm-hmm. That just because the doctors were not intervening on my behalf, I could have called hotline. I could have taken him to emergency, though he didn't want to go to emergency. Sometimes the spouse doesn't want, or the person doesn't want to go.
Right.
So what you call? I would get so many messages when I was trying to call these psychiatrists and other doctors. Like, if this is an emergency, call 911. Okay, well then, you know, I'm not the one having the emergency exactly, and so what do I do? And I think that if I had spoken to someone, or I knew someone to talk to, now I realize that I could have called the hotline myself, and they would have told me what to do. They would have helped me. They would have sent a team perhaps out to talk to Don. I would have known to not leave him alone at all, even though he was sitting in the room with me and he ran out the door, and there wasn't much I could do at that point. There might have been an intervention I could have made. And all of this are things that, unfortunately, the family of a suicide thinks about in retrospect. But some of it, I think, is applicable to people who might be going through what I did.
This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Jill Stegman, and we're talking about her life and her husband's life dealing with prednisone and the repercussions and the mood changes that happened related to his experience of long-term use of prednisone. As I said earlier in the show, I have no experience with this, so this is a conversation that's completely new to me. But I'm curious to know if other people have had experiences with prednisone or helping a loved one manage medications and medical choices going through a long-term chronic illness or some sort of health experience that caused them to have to be on a variety of medications. Because I don't think that Jill's story is unique. I think for a lot of caregivers, we're put in a position where medications across the board have side effects of some sort. No matter what it is, even an aspirin has some sort of side effects. And so we're put in a position when someone is suffering to have to weigh the good and the bad. Are the good of this the good of this medication going to outweigh the risks of the side effects? And if we see that the risks are starting to take over the benefits, then what choices do we make? Do we go off of that medication and then shorten our lives? Or do we stay in that medication and run the risk of these psychiatric side effects? And I know that this is something a lot of people face in their lives. So I'm curious to know your experiences. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're going to go ahead and open up the phone lines. We'll take a break in a moment, come back and take your calls. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Together and we'll get it undone. Someday when you hit it much lighter. Someday, yeah, we'll walk in the rays of a beautiful sun. Someday when the world is much brighter.
Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. If you have a question or comment and you're a little nervous about going on the air, I understand, but Tyler's happy to take your question and read it over the air for you. So I understand how anxiety-provoking it can be to make a call, but we'd love to hear from you. 805-781-3875. And my guest is Jill Stegman, author Jill Stegman. That must feel good to hear.
Yes, it does, finally.
Was it a title that you had before you wrote the book? Have you always been a writer, or did you find yourself kind of thrown into this new profession?
I've been writing for quite a while, probably 10 or 15 years. I started out writing short stories and an unfinished novel, like so many of us. The title came to me actually when I had an editor help me working on it, and I didn't have a title in mind at all, and she came up with this, and we decided it worked.
And I'd like to take a couple minutes to kind of just talk about Don, because you describe him as your beloved husband of 40 years. So who was this man that you stood by for 40 years?
Well, he was so many things. We met when I think it was 19 or 20. We were married young. We just did so much together. He showed me how to explore his world, which was that of athletics. And athletics. He was an avid surfer and water sports and other scuba diving. He played all kinds of athletics in high school, football, basketball, baseball. He taught me really how to exercise and the benefits of it. And it sounds like he was a fitness coach, but it was a little more than that. I remember him, our big thing was bike riding together. And he just showed me how thrilling it can be to get on a bike and to get that kind of exercise where you get the aerobics going and the endorphins going. And I loved it. And we went from there to biking in various parts all over the country. Pre-children, and then after our children were born, we took it up again in earnest.
It sounds like then for he was a very active man, and so when he was told to just get some exercise to deal with depression, he was already used to being active. So clearly that wasn't the problem. That should have been a clue at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. He had he demanded that he get an exercise cycle in his hospital room. He wasn't allowed to leave his room for a month. And so we had to do something. He was literally going stir crazy, changing the furniture around all the time.
Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Jill Stegman. And John, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. It was interesting that you were talking about prednisone. I just finished a course of it 2 days ago. I was taking it short term, though, so 5 days of full dosage. I've never taken anything where they had to wean me off it.
Mm-hmm.
So 5 days of another reduced dose, and so after 15 days, I was off it. I could see how that would be very addictive. It made me feel like Superman for those 5 days. I was taking the full dose. I was doing it for just an allergic reaction, dermatitis. They mm-hmm. didn't know what was going on, and that was it. I didn't really know anything about the drug until, I had never heard of it before. But I did read about it, when I was, started to take it. And I was like, oh, it was very heavy duty. And I'm kind of surprised that there's nothing better for dermatitis in my case.
Right.
Yeah.
And is it something then that you would take again?
Well, I've just been off it for 2 days, so we'll see how the dermatitis goes. It's still a little bit there, so it wasn't like it was totally magic and it just went away in 2 weeks. It's been, 20 days, yeah, I would definitely ask if there was something else to take.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they can do something topically, but I didn't have anybody to apply it to my back, so the pill was the best thing. So I would mm-hmm. think anybody that had to do that in case for a transplant, that's probably much more serious, but then. Maybe it then becomes a drug of choice, but everybody should be aware of side effects, especially long-term.
Absolutely. John, thank you for calling. And I think that's part of the dilemma of this conversation, right, that it's used for so many things, from hives to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and then dealing with post bone marrow transplant. Mm-hmm. So for short terms and long terms, how much information are doctors supposed to give?
Well, in fact, in my research, they said prescriptions were written from anywhere from 22 million to 66 million a year. The doctors, I think, should just be really upfront from the beginning about what can happen and to let them know immediately. And a lot of people do, the people I've spoken to anyway. Call the doctor and say, this is happening. But they didn't know. I mean, you don't know what's going on with you. So you should know in the outset that this is the serious things that can happen and not just wait and go, wow, what's happening to me? I need to call a doctor.
Right, not having to guess if it's related to what you're taking or if it's an entirely different
exactly.
experience. Because at one
sure.
point, as you said, they attributed your husband's feelings of depression at the beginning as just being a result of going through the traumatic bone marrow transplant. So no one even connected to the prednisone until much later.
That was my understanding.
Yeah. Our number is 805-781-3875. Cynthia, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just started prednisone long-term in December. And like a lot of other people, they don't get a lot of the information that what the side effects are going to happen with your body and everything else. So I'm taking a high dose, 60 milligrams a day since December. So I know the last caller said he felt like Superman, but honey, if you have to be on it for long-term, you're going to feel like you're dying. Some of my side effects, I look in the mirror, I don't even recognize myself anymore from the swelling what's called moon face. Mm. My eyes, even the sclera, the white part of my eyes, they swell. They swell up, and my eyes are always tearing. I can't really see too much of the TV. My feet have swollen. I just feel like Professor Clump on that movie.
Yes, the Eddie Murphy movie.
The Eddie Murphy movie. That's how I feel, Professor Clump. It's so humiliating. People don't even recognize me, so I've decided not to go into public places because of my self-body image, the way I look. I feel like a monster.
Were so you... Go ahead.
And then add on the depression, which you'll be crying for days, not even knowing why. Why am I crying? Why am I feeling like this? It's a horrible drug, and I have what's called an ANCA antibody. If I didn't take this medication, I would die. But some of the side effects make you feel like you're going to die anyway.
And Cynthia, were you aware before you signed on to the long-term course, were you aware of all of these potential side effects, or were they surprising to you?
Okay, well, I was aware of some of them, and I'm a nurse, so I was aware of even more than your average person. So I was aware, not because my doctor educated me, because he did not. He didn't tell me, but I already knew from you know, experience of being a nurse, I knew that the moon face was going to happen. Now, what I forgot about in medical school, because I'm a chemo nurse, not, you know, I don't deal with other things, I forgot that Cushing's disease can happen. And so I started getting these lumps, like what's called the camel hump or the buffalo hump on the back of my shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I forgot in nursing school that was a deadly side effect, one of the potential deadly side effects of the steroid. And then I also got the lumps on the side of my temples. So if you look up Cushing's disease, that's another side effect which my doctor didn't tell me about, and I forgot because nursing school was 20 years ago.
Right.
And so had I not told the doctor, man, I'm getting these lumps on the side of my head, and then I have this buffalo hump. So he had to immediately start weaning me down off of the steroids.
And so then what happens for you, Cynthia, because you said you're caught in that space of if you don't have the drug, it will take the disease will take your life, but then you're having these horrific side effects. How do you grapple with those two almost untenable positions?
Well, a lot of times I just have to remember it's either this, you know, like it's a love-hate relationship. I have to have it. I know that if I don't take the steroids, I will probably die. But there's another option, which is chemotherapy, to treat my ANCA-associated vasculitis. Mm-hmm. So that's my next step, is the doctor wants to start me on a chemotherapy, and I'm praying to God that it works, you know, so that I can get off of the prednisone.
I really appreciate you calling in to share this, and my heart goes out to you because it sounds like you're in a place where you can't win either direction.
Right. I just... stay positive and try to, you know, every single day think of something, you know, my life is, I'm okay, I'm here today, and it could be worse. So I just try really hard to stay positive because that prednisone is, it's no joke, and I don't wish it on anybody. Like I said, it's the enemy, and yet it's helping me to fight a battle.
Good going for you, Cynthia. I'm so glad that you're aware. You've got the medical background to help you support what's going on, and it was great that you contacted your doctor right away and then you're seeking some other alternatives to prednisone. But, you know, if you're on it for the long term, then it sounds like you have some support there for it.
Yes, yeah, Cynthia,
yeah,
thank you.
I just hope more people are aware that if you're on it long term, to make sure that you don't have that Cushing's disease, which could be deadly. So I just hope to educate someone out there.
My heart goes out to you, Cynthia. Thank you for calling. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. My guest is Jill Stegman, and her book is One Pill Makes You Stronger, The Drug That Scorched My Soul. And so we talked a little bit about your life with Don, and what was it like for him? Because he must have been aware of the changes that he was going through.
It's a very odd thing. I think I don't know that much about mental illness. I do know that he was aware when he was manic, and of course, that's a craving. I mean, everybody loves that feeling. You stay up all night. He started writing books. We went to Ohio and bought real estate. He took some money out of our savings and said, this is really going to be great, you know. And we went to these depressed areas in Ohio and bought house. I mean, he managed to buy these houses on foreclosure for like $10,000, $20,000 that we were going to use as rentals. And he just conceived of all this. We knew nothing about real estate or real estate development or rental, buying rentals by any means. And he did all this, and I was kind of astounded because I thought, what are we going to do? What's he doing with this money? But it actually helped, and those rentals are really actually now working well. But on the downside, he didn't realize that anything was particularly wrong with him. I think because you're the expert on this, but in terms of bipolar disease or disorder,
yes.
A lot of times people think they're fine, and they will attest to that fact to the very end that it's the other people that are the problem. They can't monitor themselves.
And I think that's what's challenging is, from a clinician's point of view, is that we tend to get people coming into therapy who, you know, probably are doing well in most aspects of their life, but they need some help getting through a tough spot, going through grieving or a life transition. But for people who are having a psychotic experience, they tend to not be the ones that seek treatment. And so that does make it challenging. And as a caregiver, as a spouse, as a loved one, it's hard to be the one to try to, as you said, you can't physically pick him up and carry him in for treatment or, you know, force him to go to the doctor. And so how do you manage, you know, you said it really tore at your relationship.
Yes.
The highs and the lows. And so how did you cope with that?
I don't think I coped very well.
Okay.
I wasn't the kind of person that would burden other people that much with his condition. I just kind of tried to avoid him if I could at times. I tried to live with it. I read a few books on dealing with living with people who had mood swings or, you know, who seemed to be in the same, you know, displaying these bipolar symptoms. And that's what I did. I just kind of toughed it out, I guess you
Laid
could
low.
Say. I didn't know what resources were available to me. I didn't know what people could do anyway. I'd tried to get the doctors to help, and they had not come through. So there I was.
And so post-experience, having written the book, I'm sure you have talked to other people who've had similar experiences as your own. And how did they cope? Or have you found people that were able to, you know, get over the other side or help a loved
Well,
one?
I actually was in a support group for bone marrow transplant survivors for a while. And I got some support from them. And some of them talked about how their wives had to drag them down to the hospital, and that's what saved their lives. And some people had not stayed in the marriage. Some people had, or their caregiving situation, be it as it may, and they had not been able to tolerate living with that person. So I think that there are support groups now for individuals living in those situations. I would be really anxious to talk to anyone who's gone through the same situation as I did, and it would have helped me at the time too, I think.
So in some ways you're still searching for kind of support or similar experiences from other people.
Sure.
It sounds like you still feel a bit alone in what you went through.
I do. I do feel alone. I know that there are families who are distraught over mental illness or something similar to what Dawn went through, living with that as a I don't know too many who are caregivers. I know that it's very, very difficult to live with someone at the level of, who is displaying psychotic symptoms like Dawn was. It's very difficult. And I don't know too many people who can stay in that situation. I know I have a friend whose son was that way, and she just, he wanted to come back and live with her after, as an adult, and she just said, I can't stand it unless, you know, you're taking your medication and you're at this level.
But also, it doesn't sound like anyone really felt that medicating Dawn's symptoms was important, that even the doctor said, well, it's all about the prednisone and we'll just lower the dosage of the prednisone. And then they expected he would just go back to his old self.
Well, that's right. I think that was the case when I approached them initially. And that was kind of their idea all along, because when he was saying he's depressed, they were saying he needed to exercise mm-hmm. more. And so I think that a lot more doctors who prescribe prednisone are more savvy about how to deal with a patient who is displaying these symptoms. If they can't wean them off, then they can prescribe things for them. And in this case, you know, I think with Dawn, an intervention with some kind of medication was really essential.
Would have been important.
Yes, yeah.
So how was this for your children? How old are they?
Well, my son now is 32, and my daughter is 29. At the time, my son was in law school, and so he was in his own world up there, and he kind of saw my husband, or Don, his father, on and off, and thought that he was a little bit loopy, but I don't think he was totally blown away when I made the call to him. He didn't think it was that bad at all. And my daughter had problems with him. She was home from college. She had just graduated from college, and she just tried to avoid him as much as possible. She'd go out with her friends, or she'd just try to not be around when he was around.
And I guess that is part of the issue that you're talking about, is that he seemed to, on paper and from his perspective when he was in a manic space, to be doing great. Mm-hmm. And so there was no reason to intercede or change things. And because the prednisone was necessary for long-term care, that there didn't seem to be any way to kind of get involved and make a change or get him back. Because it sounds like he didn't really want to get back to the way he felt before, because he didn't want to be depressed. It sounded like he traded in that depression that he had been feeling for the mania, and that felt like mm-hmm. a better course for him.
Well, yeah. I just don't think he had any awareness of what was going on with him. He did relate it to prednisone. He knew that being on prednisone made him feel terrible, and he, it's on some level, he knew it was tearing him apart. But he just kind of went along with what the doctors had prescribed, and no one was ever intervening to, you know, really even give him more than a paper pencil kind of analysis of how do you feel today? Do you feel like killing yourself or not? You know, and a lot of people aren't going to write down, you know, give those kind of descriptions when it's just not enough for someone who's been on prednisone for a long time at those high doses and has had a background of depression.
And so how has your life changed in the last 6 years?
Well, I've been through quite a lot. I think that now I'm a grandmother, so that's wonderful. I just found out a few months ago. So that's definitely a highlight. I've just gradually kind of crawled out of the abyss, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Talking to people, I'm sure that some people are getting really tired of hearing my story. I think that one thing that's really helped is not so much the writing of my book, which was actually very difficult to do, but advocacy. Mm. I'm now working with some groups to really advocate for better monitoring of drugs, steroids, and drugs like prednisone. And that it makes me feel good to be helping other people.
So you've taken your grief and been able to activate it in a way that feels like it's helpful.
That's a great way of putting it, mm-hmm. yes.
And so if people are interested in reading your book, One Pill Makes You Stronger, The Drug That Scorched My Soul by Jill Stegman, S-T-E-G-M-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
How can they find it?
Well, you can go on Amazon, and it's right there under my name. Or you can go onto my website, jillstegman.com, and the book will be displayed there and how to order it, and a little bit more about my background.
And also, as you mentioned earlier, you said you'd like to hear from people who might have had similar experiences. So if someone wanted to send you an email and share their thoughts or something that they went through, because it sounds like creating a network of caregivers who have had to struggle with a loved one on prednisone, it might be helpful to hear from them. How could they send you an email?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. In fact, probably if enough people are interested, we could start a blog. As far as I'm concerned, my email address is on my website.
Okay.
I can give it to you now too, if you'd like. That would be J A Stegman, S-T-E-G-M-A-N, @gmail.com.
Thank you, Jill Stegman. Thank you for coming in to be my guest today. I appreciate you reaching out. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and if you'd like to reach out to me, you can email me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on our Facebook page. You can leave a message there, your thoughts. You can follow us on our Instagram, elizabeth_TRT, for updates about the show. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. If you'd like to share this show or any other shows, they're all archived there, thanks to Tyler. And you can podcast our show by visiting Apple Podcasts or however you find your podcasts. Hit subscribe and the shows will be uploaded. As always, I appreciate you supporting this program and Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Oh,